It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. Pascal Donoghue faces the doll again as new information emerges from the 2020 general election campaign.
I am now aware that an unauthorised corporate donation of €434.20 was unknowingly received by Fine Gael Dublin Central.
A new Virgin Media poll lays bare the issue of housing with younger people. A shocking 9 out of 10 young adults worry they'll never own a home, and half are considering emigrating over the next year. And Hollywood, here we come. It's Ireland's best ever Oscar nominations haul, with the Banshees of Inisherin leading the way, and a first film, Os Gaeilge, to get a nod.
I've grown up speaking Irish, and it's amazing. It's such a beautiful language, and I'm so thankful that I can share it and that it's getting the recognition it deserves.
Join our conversation online with your comments and your questions on the hashtag TonightVMTP. Pascal Donoghue's election expenses scandal has rumbled on for more than a week, and today's latest instalment saw the Minister for Public Expenditure back in front of the Dáil, and he confirmed a breach of the rules on political donations after receiving a corporate donation worth more than the legal limit. The Under Fire Minister has admitted his election campaign in 2020 used vans owned by a supporter's company and will now have to arrange a refund.
I am now aware that an unauthorised corporate donation of €434.20 was unknowingly received by Fine Gael Dublin Central. This was in the form of the use of vehicles, the commercial value of which exceeded the maximum allowable donation limit of €200. SIPO have been notified of this breach, and €234.20, the amount received in excess of the allowable limit, will be refunded to the designer group.
When he was done, the opposition got into heated discussions over the minister over what he had to disclose.
So, Deputy, I don't know if you're interested in my answer or my head, but what you're going to get is the best answer that I have available.
And last week there, you wouldn't answer any of the questions because it is a cock and bull story. And you can call out time and time again, not just in terms of accepting undeclared political donations, but what a cover-up that has gone on week after week.
To determine.
Hold on.
All the information I have,
please, Minister, hold on.
Well, tonight, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has reacted to Pascal Donoghue's statement, saying it is now time to move on.
As his colleagues, we're going to support him because we believe him. But ultimately, this matter shouldn't be decided in the political partisan chamber, which is the Dáil. We have a standards commission. A complaint has been received. They're looking into it. And I think we should now move on, allow the standards commission to do its work and talk about the issues that people are really interested in.
Well, let's get more on this. I'm joined by Fianna Fáil TD Barry Cowan, Sinn Féin's Mairéad Farrell, and Fionnán Sheehan, Ireland editor with TheIndependent.ie. You're all very welcome along to the programme tonight. To come to you first, Fionnán, on this, did we get the clarity that was being sought today from Pascal Donoghue? He called it an inadvertent corporate donation. That's a new one on us. Over postering he'd assumed was done on a voluntary basis. And so many figures as well, I think, that we heard today in the Dáil, as well as the figures we got earlier today from Michael Stone.
And the figures we got last week. So there's about $4,500 worth of money going about here between Michael Stone as an individual, Michael Stone's company. And effectively what Pascal Donoghue has done is he's outlined each of these figures, but he's parceled them up in different ways. So in some cases, he benefits directly from them, but he's saying that the the monetary value didn't necessarily go to him. It went to either Fine Gael nationally or Fine Gael locally. And that would all seem to largely be related to accusations that the donations law was broken here. So all we categorically have is that there was a breach of the law. It's not just the rules or the guidelines, it's the law on his election expenses in two general elections, and similarly a breach of the law on donations, on a corporate donation that's related to Fine Gael. So you have to take each one of the payments. What the Senate's Public Office would have to do is ascertain that amount of money, where did it come from, where did it go to, under which way was it accounted for. And I was looking at a web here tonight. You've got two different donors. You've got three different recipients. You've got three different types of donations at play here. You've four different declarations, and you've one law underpinning it all. And the Public Office Commission will have to sift through all of that and determine at the very end of it, right, how many breaches are we looking at here and how serious was it?
I'm wondering, did it have to all be so complex? And is it complex in the way that donations are given or help is given during the course of an election?
Well, it is because it's governed by law. I mean, people can look at it and say, but he was just giving help to Pascal Dunham and to Fine Gael, but different entities are treated in different ways. For example, a local branch or a local constituency organisation don't have any kind of legal locus standi in terms of expenses and donations. It's either the candidate or TD and the party nationally. They are the two entities that have to account for both election expenses and also so donations. So the party locally was coming into the equation here as well, and it appeared that was kind of shifting responsibility in a different direction. So I suppose it's the law that makes it complicated. And it's there for a very valid reason, because of events that we had back in the 1990s and politicians who were previously in senior positions.
Barry Cowan, what we heard today from opposition was, and we will probably hear from Mairead Farrell again on this, the lack of plausibility in all of this. Piers Doherty calling it a cock and bull story. Roisin Shortall asking the minister, you thought it was being done on a voluntary basis. Are you really expecting us to believe it? Did Michael Stone's expenses have a paper trail? Jed Nash asked. I mean, is the story plausible?
Well, look, I wasn't there. I've heard snippets of it. The leader, the joint leader of the Social Democrats.
Catherine Murphy.
Catherine Murphy said he made a bit of a hames of it.
And it was Roisin Shortall said that.
Roisin Shortall, yeah. Okay. And it is a bit of a hames. I honestly believe he didn't realise that there was payment made towards some of the expenses incurred during the course of the election. When he was made aware of and he sought to rectify it, he attributed the payment to the Fine Gael party, as has been said. I think at that time, I did believe, based on the questioning that was coming from Piers Doherty, that it was probably a similar experience in 2020. That subsequently materialised today. Again, he has attributed the spend as an expense on the part of the party in relation to the election expense, and has sought to rectify that by making a repayment over and above the amount.
I think that's what I'm asking. With all of these questions that have been put today...
Then it boils down to should it have been classified as a donation? And you have more responsibilities if that's the case. And some would argue that the definition would indicate that. That's what SIPO will now have to adjudicate on.
I think from Pascal
Donoghue's position, he sought to put something right, not having been aware of the exact detail initially.
Michael Stone was involved in the 2020 campaign.
He was also director of elections for his party in the 2020 election too. And there's no doubt, as director of elections,
is it plausible?
Exactly. But look, I mean, he has given his He's given a fair and honest account from his perspective. He sought to put everything out there in the open. The question that remains is something that SIPA will have to adjudicate on. Is it classified as a donation to the party, or is it classified as a personal donation?
On accountability.
When they adjudicate on that, we'll see where it goes from there. In the meantime,
as has been said by the Taoiseach and others, you know, we need to move on from this. We're a week speaking and talking about it now. I don't believe it's a hanging offence. It can't always be either a hanging or get off scot-free. There has to be some proportionality in relation to these issues.
And but as you I said agree earlier, with Roisin Shortall that he made a hames of
he
it?
He did make a hames of it. And sure, God almighty, we've all made mistakes and we've all made a hames of this, that and the other, whatever the case may be. And it's not right or proper that he should in this instance either. But that's what has happened. It's an honest effort by him belatedly to rectify the matter. There's some people still have a difficulty with that rectification measure that he undertook. Right. And it's up for SIPO to adjudicate on them there.
OK. Sinn Féin would be among the parties with the difficulty with Pascal Donoghue's response. Would I be right? Was there any reassurance at all that you got today from the minister
with his statement to the Dáil? Difficulty. It's been absolutely farcical. We've had a situation over the last week where, from what I can see, the story has changed on literally a daily, if not a few times a day basis. So what the minister is now trying to make us believe is that he wasn't aware of certain things that had happened in the 2020 election, even though he had actually been questioned in relation to what happened in 2016, in 2017. So, I mean, if you were being questioned by a journalist about something that happened in 2016, you'd think you'd be very sure that that same issue didn't happen in 2020. And Claire, not only that, but the reality is, we wouldn't even have the answer to that question, or we wouldn't even know about this if it wasn't for the fact that Piers Dardy literally asked him four times last Wednesday, and I then raised it again with him on the Thursday. Yeah. So the fact is, like, it wasn't like he came into the chamber last Wednesday and he said, look, I'm going to just lay it all out on the table. I mean, he tried to tell us on the Sunday when he initially did the interview with the journalist that he was being very honest, open and honest about it. Then he was telling us on the Wednesday he was going to do the same. And now, I mean, everything, things are changing here on a daily basis.
Are you saying now, and we got the statement and the minister did take questions today, do you believe there are more questions to ask?
There's so many questions that haven't literally been answered.
What specific questions does Sinn Féin want answered at this point?
Well, for example, a clear question that he isn't able to answer, even at this point, is how many posters were actually put up, right? He's also telling us then that this is for the party, it wasn't personal. Although it doesn't appear that the other candidate in the constituency got that assistance either. We know from what the other candidate has declared in that constituency that it was costing 5,000. I mean, this is one of the smallest constituencies in the state. Anybody that has run an election will know if there was teams going out for five nights putting up posters, but especially in an urban small constituency, they'd know well that it's how many posters. And if it was only a handful,
why is the poster number, as distinct from the value of that work which he believes he's given, so important?
Oh, because, I mean, it's about the clarity of the entire thing. But also, how can you really put a value on something? And if, I mean, there was initially, there was this thing about there was 150 posters being put up over five nights. I mean, which is just, you're putting double on posters and all this stuff. But, like, and let's be frank about this. Like,
doesn't have an answer on the posters. You don't believe plausible that he wouldn't know how many posters went up?
I don't think it's plausible that he's making out that it's a small amount and it was over five nights and three teams.
What more do you want, Mairead? Do you want SIPO to do their job, or would you rather put down a motion of no confidence and we can then move on and waste another day?
There's a few things, right? First of all, I would like him to have just been honest from the very get-go, right?
But things change on a daily basis, right? We've established that.
SIPO absolutely do need to do their job, but the government also needs to give SIPO the powers to investigate. No, but that's really important because they've been calling for that for years and this minister has been in government for the last 12 years.
And I think actually the Taoiseach may have alluded to that tonight,
looking at SIPO's powers.
But you say you haven't got the answers. You say there are more questions to ask. Do you plan a motion of no confidence now?
I think at this point we need to, like, I mean, we do need to get more answers to the questions.
No, if that's it now, and that's all we're going to get at this point, the next step, and people may have assumed that Sinn Féin will put down that motion today or at least have flagged it by this time tonight, and you haven't done so. Do you plan on doing so?
Well, we're going to consider it over the next course of action.
So you don't know.
I'm not going to make a decision here right now. That's something that we're going to make a decision over the course of the next few days. But, like, I mean, come on. I don't think anybody is going to listen and think that what Pascal has done today is in any way answering all the questions.
We're not getting an answer, really, because Sinn Féin haven't made up their minds.
They
haven't made up their minds yet on if they plan a motion of no confidence. You would think if that was something they were considering, that maybe it would sort of be out by now, or we get an inkling about it. Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, there wasn't 11,000 people marching down Limerick at the weekend about Pascal Donoghue's posters and how many he put up. Like, you know, there's bigger issues out there for people. At this point now, he came into the Dáil last week. He didn't give a satisfactory explanation by any means. He's come back now with another statement and he set out all the figures. He was challenged back. There was interesting interactions tonight, particularly with on the Paul Murphy put some specific figures to him, and he was basically sticking to his story that, well, no, there's a difference between him and Fine Gael locally, when under the law, actually, there isn't. You're the candidate. You're the one who has to. So that's what Sipo now have to judge upon. Sinn Féin brought this up as the primary issue the first 2 days of the Dáil coming back last week and again today. So, yeah, the next step is to just turn around and go, we don't believe it's credible, so therefore, here's a motion. Nothing.
Yeah, well, the government won't be providing any more time for any further questioning, as far as I'm aware. So the ball is in Sinn Féin's court. If they want to put down a motion of no confidence, we can do that and get it over with, if that's the only way it can be got over with. Other than that, you know, as the fellow says, let's move on.
Like, you resigned your own position. Do you think that should have happened so quickly in your case? Like, how do you feel about ministerial resignations?
You know, my case is a matter for another day, and we can discuss that on another occasion. This issue is one which the government has faced over the last week. There's been much talk and speculation in relation to the minister coming back before the House today and putting on the record his rectifications in relation to the issues that arose over the last week. He has done that. I accept that. I accept that SIPO was given a job to do. It'll make an adjudication on the points that were made by Paul Murphy and Pearse Doherty or anybody else who made points, by virtue of the fact that it'll classify those payments as to what they were, and the ramifications or the repercussions will occur then, only then. In the meantime, the government has a job to do and the opposition have a job to do, and as Fionnán says and others have said, there are many other more pressing issues that need to be addressed and that people would like to see us addressing on a regular basis, rather than Sinn Féin agreeing to go into the Dáil again tomorrow.
Just to ask the same questions
over and over again.
Say you were to pursue a resignation, that would lead to a snap general election, as your party is well aware. That's why the stakes are so high in this one. Is there hesitancy, therefore, to push for this?
No, I think there's something like actually missing in relation to this whole thing and in terms of the debate in relation to this whole issue. It's about influence and power and who has influence and power and who has. No, it is. It fundamentally comes down to this, right?
You see, when you're saying that.
Hold on a second, Barry, let me make a point.
Over the last number of years, right since I was elected, and I don't equate the two, there has been consistently scandals within the government, be it around lobbying, whether it be about SIPO, all these kind of things, right? And if you are an ordinary person looking in and you see how you can't have access to housing, the issues in terms of the healthcare and all that, and you feel that you have less ability to, you know, to lobby your ministers and other people.
Are you talking about those thousands of people who may have been marching over the issue of health around the country?
I'm talking about the people who have been marching on health. I'm talking about the people that are coming into my clinics. I had a woman who was living in her car with an eight-week-old baby and a two-year-old baby because she cannot get emergency accommodation.
Exactly.
This is the government. And Pascal Donoghue has been a minister in that government for the last number of years who's prevailed over this housing crisis. So let's not take away the seriousness in relation
to this. That's fine if you want to go about attacking his policies, which you believe are not addressing those issues. But don't take him down or look to take him out or have him hung or hounded out of office because of €140 worth of posters or how many he put up at a certain night that you dispute. Like the people that you talk about...
Well, it's more than that now, even by his own admission, just to clarify.
Like, SIPO was put in place, Claire, to rectify and make judgments
but
and adjudications on matters
we
such
don't
as
know
this.
Yet whether SIPO will actually launch an investigation, though, do we,
exactly,
Barry?
But I expect they will, and they will come back and they'll make a judgment based on their independent professionalism as to whether they believe to be a donation to the party or a personal donation. And, you know, there will be ramifications, repercussions based on that process. In the meantime, I want to get on with the job of trying to ensure that the government responds effectively to the issues of which I was elected.
Like, I actually am baffled at the fact that last week it wasn't immediately the government said, do you know what, we're going to actually give these powers to SIPO now because they belong with Conifer and they need it.
I don't think you're going to be able to retrospectively give SIPO powers overnight
and
look at this matter.
They're
looking at it based upon the law at the moment.
Exactly, and they can make a judgment.
And actually, SIPO are fairly monumentally useless watchdog, in my opinion. I've been monitoring their activities now for many years. They never go out of their way to look into the things that are absolutely lacking in transparency. Mm-hmm. On this issue, there's a fairly clear law. It's set out under Electoral Acts of 1997. amended therein and thereafter. And there are quite clear breaches here that are being admitted to that CIPO can investigate.
What if there are clear breaches, as you've outlined, and actually as Pascal Donohue stood up and admitted to today, then is it likely that there will be some sort of penalty? And what form could that penalty take?
Up to and including imprisonment is where CIPO, where ultimately an investigation of this nature can go.
In the history of CIPO investigations, has it ever got to that?
But that's what the legislation says, and that's the legislation they will be acting under. So they will have to investigate each of these payments. They will have to say, yes, we are satisfied with this explanation, we're not with that one. They'll also have to bear in mind what rules were breached here. And they will then come back with their report, either recommending some sanction, or they will pass it on to the relevant authorities, being the Gardaí, to investigate. And indeed just conduct their own public hearing.
The Dáil is not the forum where those questioning, those decisions...
But there is also... There is accountability to the Dáil when you stand up and give a statement
and
that
the law
it turns
of the
out...
Land, and the law of the land is the CIPO has
when
a
you stand
for.
Up, as Pascal Donohue did, and he didn't give the full facts as we now know them, there is accountability to the Dáil. Would you not agree with that?
Yes, he did answer the question.
You were asked to stand in front of the Dáil and, I suppose, give your own account.
As I said to you, we can go through the rights of Robins of that on another occasion.
But
I won't be used solely as a mechanism to say two wrongs don't make a right. What I'm saying is Pascal didn't answer questions last week. He agreed to come back.
But isn't there a reason
that
minister would be obliged to stand before the Dáil?
He has done so.
He's done it three times now and he still hasn't.
Yeah, well, he's not doing it anymore because it's up to CIPO now to adjudicate on it. And
are you likely to wait to see what CIPO decides to do on this and whether they take
follow through with an investigation? In my view, right? And, like, maybe I'm the only one on this panel, but in my view, there's a lot of questions that literally do remain unanswered. And I hope that we do get some answers over the next few days. Like, in fairness, last Sunday, wasn't it? Sunday, a week ago, did he not say that was the only time he was going to comment on it? Then on Wednesday, he said it was going to be the only time he commented on it. Then I asked him questions on Thursday and he decided he was going to talk about it this week. So God knows what we're going to know in the next few...
All right.
In the next 24 hours.
It's time to move on.
All right. Well, you said it, Barry, so we will. We will actually take a break now, but my panel is staying on with me. We're going to look at a Virgin Media opinion poll that lays bare the issues facing the nation around housing. Do stay with us. Welcome back. A Virgin Media television survey has revealed that 9 out of 10 young adults fear they'll never own a home and half are considering emigrating. The State of the Nation poll was carried out nationally by Red Sea among a sample of more than 1,000 adults. Let's take a look at some new poll findings from that survey, which we can exclusively bring you tonight here on The Tonight Show. Over half of those in rented accommodation are concerned that their landlord will serve notice to leave. That's rising to 58% among 35 to 54-year-olds who are renting. Less than half of respondents in rented accommodation could move in with their parents or a family member if faced with the prospect of having to move out of their current rented property and no suitable alternatives to rent. Only 35% of those, just over a third of those aged 35 to 54, say they have this option available to them. Well, Barry Cowan, Mairead Farrell and Fionnán Sheehan are still here with me. And I'm joined on Skype tonight by Ciara O'Loughlin, who has emigrated to Australia, and Alice Linehan, who is considering leaving. You're both very welcome along to the programme. Ciara, I know it's 9 o'clock in the morning there. Thank you for joining us from Sydney. You fall just above that age threshold at 26. Can we call you a young adult? We can certainly call you a young person. You're young in my eyes, but let's talk about it. You've done that. You have made that big decision to emigrate.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Why?
Yeah, so it's really interesting that these kind of two conversations are coming up together, the emigrating and the issues that young people are facing with housing at home, because that's kind of exactly the reason that I decided to move. I mean, in March 2020, I was planning on moving to New York, but that fell through because of the pandemic. And then after that, I kind of lost a lot of money through that, and I got a job I was happy with. I decided, you know, look, travel's out of the picture for the next while anyway. But then I was living at home during the pandemic. I just wanted a bit of freedom. I wanted to live a bit close to the city. So early last year, me and my friend started looking for a two-bed apartment together. And it just proved impossible. We sent, like, I'd say close to 100 emails. We only ended up actually getting two viewings. And it was actually at one of these viewings, I kind of made a snap decision to move to Australia. We were standing in the flat. It was cold. It was old. Like, they were asking us, it was nearly $2,000 between us. And I had friends who were moving to Australia at the end of the year. So it was kind of while I was standing in that flat, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do it. And the next day I applied for my visa.
How is life there? The Taoiseach infamously said grass isn't always greener elsewhere outside of Ireland. Is it greener there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, it's not easy in any sense of the imagination. You're packing up your whole life and moving literally to the other side of the world. I actually kind of find it hard to get somewhere to live. Now, it's still within 2 weeks we found somewhere and we move in next week. So I've been on a couch for that time, which isn't ideal. And we did struggle. Like, we were at viewings like every day, about 6 to 8. I remember one Saturday we went to 12 between me and my friend, and there was like 100 to 150 people at all of them. So it's really, really competitive. But it's actually funny that there's just been an influx of Irish people who have came since Christmas, and we're all looking in the same area. So that's kind of why I think we kind of kicked ourselves in the foot there, because at all these viewings, it was mostly Irish people I was seeing. So yeah, I think that's why we found it so difficult as well. We're looking in just an area that, you know, would be quite sought after, close enough to the city, but close to the beach. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why we found it harder. Whereas if we went out further, we probably would have gotten it easier. But we are sorted now, thankfully.
Thankfully, that's good news that you got sorted there and you're settling in well at this point. Alice Linehan, Alice joins us as well. Alice, you are not in Sydney, you are in Nace. You haven't left Ireland, but at the age of 24, you're strongly considering leaving. And why is that? Is that down to the rent pressures again, the difficulty in finding accommodation? Does work come into it? What are the reasons for you?
Yeah, so I am in Nace tonight, but I rent in Dublin, and the price is, it's difficult. It's tough going. Like, a lot of my salary would have gone into rent, and I don't get paid very well for the job that I'm doing, which is just kind of the general market here. But yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I think there's a lot of pull from definitely other European countries in terms of uncontrollable things like weather and things like that, but also in terms of rent prices and what you get for your money and the general kind of standard of living in other places, what's available in big cities and things like that. And then a lot of my friends are leaving too. And one of the things that keeps me in Dublin is community and people. And when they're all leaving, you kind of get tempted to do the same.
Do you think it's likely then it's something you say you're considering? Our survey has found that people are considering, and there's a difference, I suppose, between considering doing it and actually doing it. Do you think it's likely to happen for you that you will leave Ireland?
Yeah, my kind of current plan at the moment is to stay here. I have a lease until the end of October, I think, and then maybe move home for a couple of months, save some money, and then maybe this time next year look at going somewhere else.
All right, let's bring our panel in at this point. Barry Cowan, to come to you. When you hear those stories from Ciara and from Alice, and you see the statistics that we're talking about half of people, half of 18 to 24-year-olds are considering emigrating within the next year. That's a big lack of hope for the future here. Do you find it depressing?
It's very disappointing to hear those figures, to hear those details. And it only reinforces the wish and the want on the part of those of us who've been afforded the opportunity to be in Parliament, to work with government to address these issues. I have three children myself that work in Dublin. One lives in Dublin, the other two commute. They can't afford to live there. And that's difficult for them, and it's hard for me to see that. What can I or what have we done about it?
Do they blame government?
They see it as very an issue that has to be addressed, that needs to be more work put into. Yes, of course. But then if you look at the most recently, 400,000 people qualify for a tax rebate in relation to rent worth €500, only less than 20% have applied.
That's if your landlord, of course, is signed up.
Now,
the tenancies
in relation to, we've had 28,000 housing starts this year, or last year you have 16,000 first-time buyers, new cost rental schemes, new affordable schemes, but it's still not enough. I accept and appreciate that.
Do you think that will ensure that another generation is not lost to emigration?
No, look, I can only deal with the here and now. I can deal with, as a member of a government party, and who helped negotiate the programme for government. And within that, Fianna Fáil took it upon themselves to take this brief, as difficult as it was, in an effort to bring some new initiatives. And you see cost rental, you see affordability, you see 80,000 to reinstate vacant homes.
Yeah, you can see people.
And you see this week the Planning and Development Act will be amended to try and address the whole issue of objections to planning applications at a time of crisis when it's taken up to 4 and 5 years in some instances.
Of course.
To bring those schemes to bear.
Is there a lot being done? Yes, there is.
Is it working? Not yet. Is there progress being made? Yes, there is. In relation to the rental sector, I would hope to see, and I would be pressing on government to ensure that there's some tax concessions given to those landlords that offer long-term leases to try and get people back into that sphere, because a lot of people are leaving.
Oh, so you're saying
landlords are getting out of the market.
Tax breaks for landlords.
I'm saying
will
tax
help.
Breaks for those who can offer long-term lease, which gives security of tenure at a time when there's none.
Tax breaks for landlords is one of Barry Cowan's solutions to what we're seeing here, the idea that young people have left or considering leaving strongly in big numbers within the next 12 months, according to our survey.
I have never seen it as bad, like in the last 10 years. Say I did my Leaving Cert in 2008, which was not a good time to be doing your Leaving Cert, looking out into the future. So many of my friends emigrated. It's unbelievable the amount that emigrated. And now to see again, and you see it and you hear it. Like I hear it from friends of mine. I hear it from people I went to college with. I hear it when I'm knocking the doors. People keep saying to me, look, I'm going to go to Australia. So there's literally nothing here for me. That is really concerning that in a 10-year period, we're literally seeing that all happen again. And it's no question, it's because of housing. And now I have friends who are trying to come back or who have come back and they've had to I'm talking about married couples who've had to move in with parents because there's literally nothing there. There's people coming who work in the HSE who can't get full-time jobs. They're working sort of contract jobs, can't get housing, have no opportunities. And it is really, really concerning when we have a situation where young people, again, are having to look as far afield as Australia. And of course it's difficult to move. You're moving your whole life all the way across the world in a totally different time zone and not easy to get home if there's an emergency. It is really, really difficult.
OK. Fiona, on this, it feels like this generation is bearing the brunt of the dysfunctional housing market. And it's the outstanding reason for people leaving the country. Different to other times when people have left. Different to, say, in the 80s when the whole economy was in recession and that's why people had to go. We keep hearing about this bouncing economy and how we're going great. But when it comes to actually people having a roof over their heads, we can't get that right.
And different to 20 years ago, the last time we were approaching full employment as a nation where people were going abroad just because, they were young and they felt, right, grand, I can go away for a couple of years and come back. There seems to be a sentiment now coming across that people are going away and they're not really sure they'd like the idea of going away just while they're young for a couple of years. We're not really sure that the problems will be rectified within that time period. The part of the problem as well is that we actually, for the last couple of years, we've had net migration into the country. It'd separate out any issues around people fleeing war or refugees or anything like that, just in terms of workers coming into the country. We've had net migration. So we're losing the workers that we are training up in valued areas where we have shortages because of the housing problem. So it is that case of unless you have all the pieces in place, you won't be a functioning society.
It also appears to me, and I don't know, Ciara, what you think of this, that it is a country divided here in Ireland. Like most people in this country, and we tend to forget about it when we have this conversation, they're homeowners. There's people sitting pretty at home who don't face the problem that you face. Do you think that the government, do you think the state cares enough about that 18 to 24-year-old cohort, those who are, you know, 30, beyond 30, who find themselves in this situation, that they're still at home, that they can't pay rent, that they never see themselves being able to afford a home?
No, I don't think so, because I think it's even interesting when we're having this conversation, it's talked about a lot that people my age worry they'll never be able to afford a home. But actually, when I'm talking to my friends, owning a home doesn't even really come up in the conversation. We're worried about getting somewhere to rent, you know, like none of my friends in Dublin are living in what would be their kind of ideal rental situation, excuse me. They're living in, you know, a house share with people they don't know, and it's very lonely, and then others are living at home. So, yeah, it's not a great situation, and yeah, really needs to be fixed.
Yeah. Alice, I don't know if you heard our panel there and asking, you know, Barry Cowan, from a government point of view, is enough being done here, that progress is being made, but it's, you know, a sense that it's not coming quickly enough, but it will come. Is there a hope that actually it is a problem that can be fixed and that you may not have to leave? Or if you do leave, you can come home within a couple of years, and you will be able to get sorted, and you will be able to afford somewhere to live and somewhere, you know, happy to work and live your life?
Yeah, I don't know. Right now, it seems like quite a distant possibility, just because right now it's so unattainable. And as it was already said, the conversation of owning a home just doesn't come up with me and my friends. Maybe 24-year-olds don't talk about that kind of thing, but it's really, really not something that feels likely. And even if I think about in the future, if I wanted a house or whatever, I don't even think about the possibility of owning a home. It would be an apartment, something like that, something that's a little more maybe within reach. I hope it's something that can be fixed. I know so many people who've left who want to raise a family in Ireland, who want to come back eventually, but it's going to have to be something that's affordable and that makes sense, as opposed to living somewhere else where they can afford it and where their quality of life is better.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. My thanks to Ciara O'Loughlin and to Alice Linehan, who joined us on Skype, and to Barry Cowan and Mairead Farrell. Fionnán is staying on with me as we take a look at an astoundingly good day for Irish film in the Oscar nominations. Welcome back. It's been a monumental day for Irish film, with a record-breaking haul of Oscar nominations. The Banshees of Inisherin was tipped to do well, and it didn't disappoint, collecting 9 nominations, including 2 in the Best Supporting Actor category. And An Cailín Chún became the first film Os Gaeilge to pick up a nomination for Best International Feature Film.
It was probably the most tense moment of my life, just waiting, because, you know, we were the last film to be called out amongst the 5 nominees. So, it was just incredible. It was like, I don't know, it was like Italia 90 all over again or something. It was just amazing, yeah.
Paul Mescal also picked up a nomination for his leading role in After Sun. Fionnán Sheehan is still here with me. I'm also joined by journalist Mike Sheridan. You're welcome to the programme, Mike. A huge day for the Irish. It is the most successful run of nominations in the Oscars, it can be said, for Irish entries.
Yeah, I think you have to go back to In the Name of the Father in the early 90s. That got a bunch of nominations. And obviously the Jim Sheridan movie, My Left Foot, had gotten a bunch of nominations in 88, 89. So it's been a while since we've had this kind of reverberation of success. And it's brilliant to see, I think, particularly Paul Mescal. That kind of, he was mentioned, like the movie was very well received, but from to get an Oscar nomination, kind of, I think he was even surprised by that.
Yes, because Colin Farrell is also in the same category for Best Actor. And many of those nominated, that's Colin Farrell, Paul Mescal, Brendan Gleeson, Kerry Condon, they are all first-time Oscar nominees as well. So added excitement there.
Yeah, and I remember seeing something years ago when Jeremy Renner was nominated for an Oscar for The Hurt Locker. It would have been maybe 2009, 2010. And Colin Farrell was on stage. He had actors on stage introducing each nominee. And there was a piece, I think it was in Variety, it was in one of the trades saying, why have Colin Farrell and these other actors on stage? They're never going to be nominated for an Oscar. And I remember reading at the time being like, a little harsh, because he was always a very good actor. Mm-hmm. He maybe wasn't getting the material. And now he's got a very, very good chance of taking home an Oscar.
Yeah. Fionnán, it must be said there is a feel-good factor still associated with all of this, is there, when the Oscars comes around and we get the likes of Irish movies doing well, or tipped to do well at least?
There's a great buzz, but yeah, you also have to factor in that if you're reading kind of Variety and the US critics, LA Times and so on tonight, they're kind of not really tipping Banshees of Inisherin for a whole lot of these accolades. You know, Brendan Fraser is in there as well, another Hollywood redemption story. There are other big movies in there that are favourites.
Of course, The Fablemans.
Yeah, The Fablemans, which flopped at, you know, not doing well at the box office, but yet critically acclaimed as well. Tar, which is supposed to be an epically boring 3 hours, is also critically acclaimed. So you can fall between two stools at these events. You can get a whole host of nominations, you can sweep the boards, or you can end up getting very little out of it. Colin Kuhn's nomination is absolutely fantastic, but you know, again, up against All Quiet on the Western Front, which was, it's a big budget production of a movie that has been done twice before as both a TV
Colin
series.
Kuhn has been incredibly well received. I mean, prior to all the Oscars buzz and all of that last, when it first, you know, came on stage.
Yeah, the little film that could. It's incredible to see, and it's got serious momentum now as well, I think, coming into the Oscars.
There's a lot of work behind the scenes, isn't there, to get that. I mean, I heard Colin Barrett, and he was speaking of all the support that you get then from Irish actors in Hollywood. There's a lot of sort of behind the scenes and lobbying that goes on as well in terms of building support and building momentum for movies.
Yeah, it's no harm once you've got those kind of Irish-Americans, those second, third, fourth generation Irish-Americans fighting your corner, and they have Academy votes, absolutely.
Briefly, who's likely to pick up awards, do you think, from the Irish contingent we're talking about? Fionnán's dampened it all a bit now. But do you believe that Colin Farrell could get it for Best Actor? Does Paul Mescal stand a chance?
No, Paul Mescal, I don't think, really stands a chance. You never know, the vote could be split, but I would imagine it's going to be Brendan Fraser or Colin Farrell. I mean, we've got two actors in Best Supporting, and then obviously Kerry Condon in Best Supporting Actress as well. But I would say Colin Farrell and The Quiet Girl are probably our best bet.
OK, well, in the last hour, in other news, Virgin Media brought you a documentary looking at Donald Trump's latest tilt at the US presidency and the supporters still worshipping his every move. Take a look.
He was sent by God. He was sent by God to preserve Abraham Lincoln's promise that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people will not perish from the face of this earth.
And Joe Biden is expected to announce his own re-election bid in the coming weeks, with a rerun of the 2020 election race a distinct possibility now. Both men now contending with the same headache, classified documents. The last week has seen the Biden White House thrown into chaos with documents found at the president's home. We actually had Mike Pence, then the former vice president, also bringing his work home. Is this what they do? They just bring their classified documents home with them?
Well, they all get daily briefings. The vice president and the president is given a briefing every day, and there's a lot of documents. Obviously, that happens over the course of a year. So, I mean, stuff is going to go missing. I would say you have Obama, Clinton, you know, Bush, George W. Bush.
But it is being viewed as a huge misdemeanor.
It is. I think it was made a big deal with Donald Trump, because Donald Trump, the way he handled it, there was 300 documents. Apparently, there was nuclear documents in there. He said he gave them all to the archives. He hadn't. That's why there was a raid in Mar-a-Lago. Joe Biden's at least cooperating. But it was interesting seeing Mike Pence on January 12th doing an interview saying, how could Joe Biden be so careless? And Joe Biden doing a similar interview a few months ago saying, how could Donald Trump be so careless? So they're all kind of putting their hands up now going, they're having their lawyers look and they're cooperating.
Yeah, and 2024 isn't that far away. Like, it's a year away. Funny, since Donald Trump announced that he was going to run in 2024, we haven't heard much from him. I wonder where that campaign is going now. We do have all the Mar-a-Lago controversy and various proceedings against him at civil level, as well as, you know, all the Capitol riots and all the rest of it. Where does it leave Trump and his support base, which we could see from Richard Chambers' documentary that ran before this programme, is clearly still very strong at its core.
And the problem is, there's always the suspicion with Trump that this is always a money-making scheme, that in effect he will take donations and contributions, he will allow super PACs to be set up to actually do the work on the ground, and that won't come out of his funding. So it's a bit depressing, really, when you look at the Republicans after the last presidential election, the fallout from that, that is still what he is still what's been regarded as their number one candidate. And also, you have to say, on the Democrat side, it's not exactly inspiring that Joe Biden, you know, much and all the great record as he had at his age, is their number one pick for next time either. Kamala Harris seems to have sunk without a trace. Still in a bit of disarray in a new regime taking over inside the House as well.
Yeah, interesting that you're mentioning there about Joe Biden's age. He is due to announce his run for re-election in the next couple of weeks. If he does, and he is re-elected for another term, he will be 86 by the end of that term. Does that play a factor that, you know, people would decide, look, he simply doesn't have the energy for the job at this age?
Yeah, he said he was running.
It's one of the most powerful jobs in the world.
Absolutely. And he said he was running because he thought he was the only person who could beat Donald Trump. And in fairness, he did beat Donald Trump. But you've also got people like Gavin Newsom, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris as well. She's not very popular at the moment. But she was very popular when she was announced to be his running mate. And these things are cyclical. I don't think it's going to be Trump as the nominee in 24 for the Republicans. I think it'll be Ron DeSantis. I think they get what they need policy-wise from Ron DeSantis without the messiness of Trump.
Trump is ahead of him in polling, though, and polls that have been carried out now ahead of Ron DeSantis, despite everything that's going on in Trump's life.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like to see Ron DeSantis on the debate stage with Trump, because apparently he's quite stiff in debates. But there was an NFL game a few days ago, and Ron DeSantis was at it and was in Kansas. It wasn't in his state, it wasn't in Florida. So he won by 20 points. And he was very well recognised, very well regarded. He was getting clapped, he was getting cheered. And that's something that surprised the American media.
Yeah. And we do love to talk about Donald Trump and, you know, how on earth this man came to be president, and really, is he going for it again? But what about Joe Biden in all of this? You touched on it there. You said you found it a bit depressing, Fionnán. Like, the idea of him being another 4 years in office, do you think that would be good for Ireland? Does it make a difference? Is there a new energy required at the White House now? Like, he has very low in approval ratings the midterm success.
Suit us fine to have Joe Biden there for another 4 years. We'd have the access. We have the Irish-American shtick that we have there. We'd have a Democrat in the office. We tend to have a greater affinity there, even though a lot of Irish-Americans are actually, in reality, Republican voters. So great for Ireland if Joe Biden is there for 4 years. It doesn't exactly renew and reinvigorate politics, though, in the United States.
It's worth pointing out as well, Mike Pence's grandfather's Irish. That's not something that's spoken about a lot.
No, it's not.
Like, he's second generation.
Good reason, some would say.
Yeah, exactly.
And what happens with Pence and all of this? I mean, he was considering a run as well, wasn't he?
He is considering a run. I mean, he'll have to raise the money. I think he's polling about 6-7%. Nikki Haley saying she's going to run as well. She's a governor of South Carolina. She might be more going for a VP slot. But it's going to be between Trump and DeSantis, how messy that debate stage gets. Mm-hmm. If DeSantis does announce he's going to run, will be a mess. It'll be like 2016 multiplied by 10, I think.
Yeah, and question is, do these classified documents and the controversy surrounding that for Joe Biden pose a risk to him?
I don't think so. I mean, I think so many people are coming out now. Like today it was Mike Pence saying, oh, look, we found some as well. I don't think it's as big a deal.
All right. OK, well, there we leave it. My thanks to Mike and to Fionnán and all our panel tonight. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. You can also now find us on Instagram and on TikTok. But from all the late team here, good night and take care.